I'm very pleased to welcome to Fremantle Shipping News Kevin Price, author of a just about to be launched thriller called Poetic License. Welcome, Kevin.
Thank you, Michael. Pleased to be here.
I should tell our listeners that, in fact, it's Dr. Kevin Prince and...
Price.
We're having fun with names. Dr. Kevin Price, and an earlier version of this was your PhD manuscript.
Yes. A lot of creative writers come to their writing practice through a PhD investigation, inquiry, I suppose. And mine was really an inquiry about the role of story in the teaching of creative writing and the practice of creative writing. So in order to investigate the role of story, I actually had to have a story.
Let's come back to that, because I'm really interested in the number of people I keep discovering who've done the creative writing courses, have earned PhDs and other postgraduate accolades, and gone on with their writing that way. It's an interesting phenomenon for me, at least. But poetic license, let's just talk about it for a minute. I've just finished reading it, and I can tell you, Kevin, I thought it was truly a thriller. I think that's a proper description of it. Perhaps in your own words you can tell the readers, because you don't want to give away too much. What's going on here?
Poetic license centres around a question of who profits from boats on the water. Now, it's a philosophical question because it's in a very specific period. In the lead up to the 2013 federal election, which was contested between Tony Abbott and Kevin Rudd following the Gillard years, in the lead up to that, the one central issue was boats on the water.
We're talking refugees, or people used to call them illegals,
yes,
sort of thing.
Yes, so the idea that refugees would be coming here on leaky boats out of Indonesia was something that was constantly raised in that election period, specifically by Tony Abbott. He had a scoreboard, and every day he would put new numbers on the scoreboard, the new number of boats arriving, the new number of illegal aliens arriving, the new number of deaths at sea. So this became a curious question to me, and I've been interested for some time about political manipulation and how politics generally manipulated, often by big money, and the question occurred to me, well, what if somebody funded this flotilla of refugees finding asylum in Australia and continued to fund it so that there was always this talking point that overshadowed the election, and of course the simple solution of Operation Sovereign Borders, we'll stop the boats. And I think, you know, I mean, even in the current election, lead up to this current election, you've got Morrison rehashing the same arguments, trying to trade on exactly that same thing.
Creating a threat that may not exist.
Well, I don't necessarily think it was a threat, you know. We now have a problem of not having enough what we might call immigrant labour. We're not having enough immigrants on the ground. And one of the characters in this book makes a point of saying, you know, look, you know, if we're going to go to wars in other people's places, we ought to be responsible enough to make it safe for the people we displace.
In this book, that backdrop you've just described is ever there, but at an easier to see surface, and the listeners here will have just had a motorbike tearing down Phillimore Street in the background, you've set this book in Fremantle. You can tell me in a minute why, although the answer perhaps is obvious. It's just a fantastic place to set a thriller. And you've got people with names that the poets must have worked on before you found them. Enzo Giordini.
Gordioni.
Oh, you call him Gordioni. Oh, Gordioni.
Gordioni.
And you've got Roger Lamorne.
Yes.
You've got Art Lazar.
There's a story to Art Lazar.
Let's come back to it. And you've got Hunter. And it's not only that, you've got a detective, Kelly Bolter. There are other names, and I just love where people get names from. So what's the story for Art Lazar?
Well, you know Lucky Oceans.
Yes, I do. You'll find a lovely podcast with him on Fremantle Shipping News if you search.
Many years ago, Lucky was in a band called the World Famous Oralettes, and I was their record producer at the time, and I had worked for quite some time with the World Famous Oralettes, and they did a lot of quirky things among their shows, and one of those quirky things was a little segment they did called Red Faces, and the idea was that somebody from the audience would perform something on stage and of course create a red face. So this particular night I showed up on stage with a double bass. I am a bass player, but this particular double bass came in pieces. So there was a body and there was a neck
and a body
and no strings.
No strings.
So we picked a song and it was sort of like, and I sang the bass part. And when I left the stage, Lucky Ocean said, "Well, there you have it, ladies and gentlemen, Art Lazar."
It just came out.
But I think Lucky's expression of it was Artless R.
Oh.
Artless R U. Well, the name sat with me for a long, long time. And it was kind of my go-to persona, if you like.
If you got lost at a party and someone said, "Who are you?" You said, "I'm
Artless
R."
So when I started my my pathway to this PhD, I was often writing under Art Lazar. Art Lazar was sort of this voice I could use that wasn't necessarily me. He's quite a famous character in my small world.
Well, you've got, in a sense, everybody. You've got Gordini, as you've mentioned. I mean, this is a man who's one of your villains. I mean, he's a gangster. You've got Roger Lamorne. Some people might want to say that he's a gangster too, but he's a lot smoother. This is a man who doesn't want to exercise hard power. He's happy to be invisible almost.
Well, yes, Lamorne sort of has a background where he came here as an orphan from the UK on a ship and was put on the back of a truck at Fremantle Harbour and transported to Bindoon, where he was abused by priests and brothers. And he ran away and he found solace in the family of an Italian wine grower, the Lucchese family in the Swan Valley. But the brothers Lucchese kind of diddled him out of what the senior Lucchese promised him in later years. And Roger sort of decided that revenge was a nice way to make a position in the world. He became a stockbroker and got to know an awful lot of wealthy, high net worth wealthy people in that particular role. And he learnt the craft quickly. He's a very smart man. He's a very smart learner. And he learnt how to build things without making much noise about them. And so he built this empire called Sanco, which does a bit of everything. You know, it builds things, it provides remote services, it provides, it operates prisons, it operates detention centres, it operates food production facilities.
And makes a lot of money.
Makes an awful lot of money.
And that gives power.
Well, yes, but he found that power from just money alone wasn't entirely satisfying. So he became political. And what he found was that influence was far more satisfying and far more powerful. So he rose to the top of being a power broker with the Liberal Party. He's got a lovely Cottesloe. He's got built a mansion out in the Swan Valley, but he's got a lovely Cottesloe office, which is sort of like a
Marine Terrace looking to Rotterdam.
Of course, you know, it sort of looks like a ship's superstructure, and you know, he operates everything out of there, but it's a very secure facility. And I just think the idea that Le Morte conjures, at least for me, is an idea that we do have very powerful people in our community who can influence the outcomes of most things. The problem for him, though, is that he's in Western Australia.
You need a larger playing field.
Well, you know, you do realise that the Liberal Party would never, ever, not ever, allow a leader to come from Western Australia.
There's another character here, a Vice Chancellor.
Ah, yes, Wallace Lipschitz.
We won't try to spell that, and you need to be careful how you pronounce it. But it sounds like a suitable name for Vice Chancellor. It has a sort of a European, transatlantic, transpacific,
nicely Germanic, I think.
Something to it. And Vice Chancellors aren't to a penny, but they seem to come often, regularly, to all sorts of universities. And apparently, I couldn't imagine what the name of the university is, but it's on the south side of the river by all accounts.
Yes, it's a southern university.
What's happening with this VC, and why is the VC in the story?
Well, Art Lazar has got a gig as an academic teaching creative writing. Now, Lazar's history puts him in a fairly difficult position because he started life as a journalist and he was working for the West Australian newspapers, and they sent him to Kalgoorlie as a cadet. Off to the Kalgoorlie Minor, where he met the man we now know as Hunter, who was his mentor. The guy who is now running the very noble Fremantle Herald, Ree Porter, who was the bureau chief at the time. And back in the early 1970s, Kalgoorlie was pretty much a Wild West place where you had police commissioners, superintendents in bed with the local madams, at literally and in business.
And things happened historically out of Kalgoorlie, and lots of people were running scared.
Yes, and one of the things that did happen in Kalgoorlie was, coming off the back of the great nickel boom, was a lot of American influence and American money. There were things that were of great interest at the time, apart from mining. There was the installation of the Pine Gap spy centre, and also Exmouth base was on notice. And Gough Whitlam's government at the time had put both of these propositions on notice, and Charlie Court's government had just come to power, and the events that occurred in Kalgoorlie were the trigger to...
So you've got these journalists who've forged relationships, is probably the best way to call it, which are pretty deep. One of whom is Hunter, we'll come back to him, who actually provides a lot of the link for the story. Art Lazar, who's not like Hunter, who's a bit underground. He's out there, but he's in this curious role at the university, and you've got this Vice Chancellor. What is it that the Vice Chancellor apparently is up to?
I think the Vice Chancellor is really seeking... The Vice Chancellor, well, Lipschitz is kind of, his heart's in the right place, but he's his ego is probably far outstripping his capacity to manage things. And so what happens with Lipschitz is he wants to build a better university, but he wants to build it in a different way. So he doesn't want to follow the rules. And so he's trying to build a whole new film studio on campus, and he's trying to build a new campus in Malaysia, and he's trying to set up good prospects for Malaysian students to come to here, and he's so Roger Lamort is one of his best mates.
Well, the VC is dealing with all of the movers and shakers who he thinks are important.
Absolutely.
Including Lamort. And including the leading politicians in Malaysia.
Well, the Prime Minister at the time, whose dodgy dealings were are fairly well known now. But, you know, the idea of making these sorts of connections is quite important to Lipschitz, because he thinks that's what being the modern vice chancellor is about. But unfortunately, it breaks the rules, because universities are, in fact, public property, and they belong to us. And
so we're seeing degrees of personal power and influence. We're seeing politics. We're seeing, in the sense of gangster at work, we're seeing a university, a large public institution, which can influence so many young and older minds as life goes along, all being brought together into this story. And is there some sort of subterranean or not so subterranean theme here that we might all be saved by journalists?
That's an interesting, I hadn't thought about that. That's a really interesting proposition.
Well, put it another way, who stands up for, you know, life, justice in the Australian way here?
Exactly. And it is the journalists, in a way, you know, the real journalists, the journalists who are doing their job of holding power to account. Lazar's problem, of course, is that the events that unfolded in Kalgoorlie in 1974 cost him his journalism job, because he was given a choice. At the time, he could either be healthily disappeared down a mining pit, or he could do some work for the government, for a secret government agency. The tenure of that job, of course, is for life, but he never knows where he's going to be, and it's not permanent, and the pay's not that good.
He's like the red dare for the government. He goes in. We assume the red will have to work this out for themselves. On the side of the good guys, but Hunter, who had been his mentor, Art's mentor, he's disappeared from sight.
Yes. Well, you'll have to wait for the next novel to learn more about him. But Hunter's original name is Calvin Bishop, and what we do learn in poetic license is that 10 years ago he disappeared at sea. But he's returned here as a homeless person in Fremantle. And the homelessness of Fremantle really did disturb me, because this book is set in the lead up to the 2013 election. And I had a conversation with a person who'd been living on the streets for quite some time, a couple of years before that. And I had a conversation with a person who'd been living on the streets for a couple of years, and it occurred to me that homelessness of Fremantle was really quite problematic. And I learnt that on any given August night, and that's the coldest month here, on any given August night, there'd be as many as 1,500 people sleeping rough in Fremantle. And I thought, Jesus, that's a lot of people. And while there are some services being provided, and some of them are recognised in the book as people providing services, nothing's really done to address the issue that underlies homelessness in the first place, and which is sort of described by a minor character in here as you know, a loss of economic personal economy and a loss of social connection, and it just disintegrates.
It's a nice treatment, if I might say so, Kevin, of the homeless people that you find around. A number of the homeless people in Fremantle, I think, are known by name to many of the people who run businesses and work in the centre of Fremantle, and that sort of comes through in the book. That, and in some ways, they're some of the quiet heroes in the book too. They're keeping an eye out for people.
Well, they keep an eye out for each other. And poetic license applies to almost everything in this book, okay? But the central poetic license is Art Lazar's ability to move between the cracks. Mm. And he's given this ability by a secretive government agency, and he takes some poetic license with that at times by going off-piste. That's P-I-S-T-E.
When you say off-piste, yes.
Not P-I-S-S-E-D. Anyway, but poetic license applies everywhere else as well, because what we're finding is that people like Hunter, who's hiding from the Gordioni family, because, just skipping back a little bit, he won a Walkley Award for his work on the WA Inc. story, bringing what's called the bastards of the WA Inc. to account. And he was working at the time on looking at drug movement through the port. And as he got closer and closer to the sources of drug movement through the port, because it's cocaine gets here somehow, and he kind of targeted the Gordioni family, because Enzo Gordioni runs a freight forwarding business out there on the
other side of the
other side of the river. But not only does he run a freight forwarding business, he pretty much controls what goes on
over there,
portside. And so Hunter kind of got a little bit close, and he was threatened, but it was his wife and child who were threatened. In other words,
disappears from them.
You disappear or they get hurt. So he disappeared. But he came back disguised as a homeless person, because he knew no Gordioni would ever look a homeless person in the eye. And you know, they soon across the street.
It works. And the people who are going to read this, who are listening to us now, we give them a certain amount. But it's important to introduce these various characters, because you link them together in the most wondrous way. The story is fast-paced. It gets quite gripping. And we haven't even talked about Kelly Bolton. Probably shouldn't speak too much
about him. So there are four characters who drive the story, right? So there's Art Lazar, who's the sort of the present character.
Yes.
And his voice is constantly in the first person and in the present.
And he's linking just about everybody else.
Yes. Hunter, who Alan Carter describes as a... original and kick-ass protagonist. thank you, Alan. Hunter sort of plays more of a guardian role to Art Lazar, but he's the one who draws Art Lazar into this problem. The problem being keeping a young asylum seeker who has escaped detention.
And whose brother had been murdered.
Whose brother has been murdered, yes. So the problem is to keep her safe, because the people who murdered her brother are looking for her.
They're going to kill her.
And so this lands on Hunter's lap, which also means it lands in Art Lazar's lap. But of course, in order to keep her safe, we have to solve a murder. And Lazar kind of says, well, you know, if there's a photograph of the victim, then just give it to the cops and they'll know what to do with it.
Can you trust the cops?
Well,
Kelly Bolter enters.
Kelly Bolter, who has history with Art Lazar, and it's not very comfortable history.
Well, probably not.
She's
and she's beautiful.
She's beautiful. Yes, she's. She's
this is an unusual line for a thriller.
Yeah, she's a really interesting person,
she
Kelly
is.
Bolter. She's twice the state champion for weightlifting, but you wouldn't imagine it.
She's not that tall.
She's not tall, and she's quite diminutive in many ways, but she's powerful, and
she reads people well, including her bosses.
Yes, she does. But she's learned how to do that because she suffered a fairly unfortunate beginning to life and found her way into policing through forensic science because she did medical training in the Navy I won't sort of say what this is about. You'll have to read it, but she did medical training, which led her to forensic science, and she's actually very interested in forensics investigations. But she's also a very capable role player, which gives her power as an undercover operation,
yes.
Undercover cop. And so she's done gigs as an undercover cop in the past, and this is where she met Art Lazar originally, and that scene is actually recounted for the benefit of the reader. And of course, Lazar is besotted by her on first meeting, but he doesn't realise that she's playing him. And by the time he does realise, of course, it's too late. But his relationship with Bolter kind of has this tension about it, which I think allows the story to progress.
I think she's very, very important. So I gather from what you've told us, and we're not telling anyone anything about the end of the book, there's more to come, another book, and we'll have Hunter in it at least, will we?
Oh, there's two more books.
Yes.
Which will involve these characters.
Good.
There's a story that precedes this, which I in fact wrote as a television piece, but it never went anywhere as a television treatment or a script. So I'm converting that into a novel that precedes this.
The prequel.
This novel, yes. But it's Hunter's story.
It's Hunter's story. And then there's one to follow this.
And there's one to follow it, which will be a legal thriller, which has its genesis in this next book, the one previous to it.
Before we leave the book, we should mention Balsamic and Olives, a restaurant on North Shore. Wonderful creation. I want to go there, Kevin. Are you going to set it up?
Well,
we won't tell the reader
if we sell about 4 million books.
You need to fly an international chef's to run
Balsamic and Olives. Well, actually, I cannot remember who it was, but I overheard a comment where people were talking about the kind of Islamic jihad, you know, and somebody said, "Oh, you mean a balsamic jihad?" And I thought, "Shit, that's good," you know. So this book was actually called The Balsamic Jihad.
Until the name changed.
All the way through its...
The working title.
Through its working development. And because I just like that concept, you know, the humour that's attached to it.
Yes.
I love wordplay. Wordplay is kind of a thing. And you will find a lot of wordplay in my writing because it's what I like to do.
Yes.
So Balsamic and Olives was sort of part of that original nomenclature.
Mm.
But you'll also notice that Hunter's street name for his, so he provides a weekly piece for the Fremantle Herald,
yes,
under a byline called Balsamic.
I get it now.
Right? And so the idea of sort of playing, just playing with words becomes kind of part of
the... There's a lot of fun things going on. If your musical education can be advanced with links to various artists and songs, wow, as we go through, getting a sense of what's in your record library.
I've got to thank my good friend Norman Jorgensen for something here. We were having coffee and we were talking about the way music works as a way of positioning characters. So Art Lazar is stuck in the 70s. So almost every reference that comes out, and there's a lot of musical references in here, and every reference that comes out sort of takes him into that place, you know, and he sees the world through a lot of his musical experiences. And Norm said, why don't you use song titles for your chapters? And I thought, Norm, that's a really lovely idea. Thank you for that. And I did.
And you did.
One recent reviewer sort of puts a tail line on his review and says, it took me a while to work out that the chapter titles were all song titles, so I've made up a playlist. Well, there is already a playlist on Spotify for this, you know, for the whole collection of songs.
Yeah, it's wonderful. I'm pleased to see that Glenn Frey appears in the middle of all of that too.
Yes. Well...
The late Glenn Frey. But tell me this. How did you get into this writing caper in the first instance? What got you wanting to do your PhD? What got you to follow this through? What got you to produce and have close to ready the next two novels?
I think my life has been a journeyman to some extent. I've worked in so many different fields, doing so many different things. And I never felt as though I'd ever actually finished anything. So in about 1987, I took a bit of a break from life, because things had come to somewhat of a cul-de-sac. And I went back to the family farm for 6 months and just to refocus on what it is I might do. And Bryce Courtney and Peter Carey became my companions. And I thought, these guys, advertising novelists, doing pretty well. That's it, I'll be a writer. So I made a decision that I would become a writer. And I when I came back to the city, I studied some University of Western Australia extension programs in marketing. I got a gig with a local advertising industry magazine, writing feature articles. And also a local lifestyle magazine, writing feature articles. And that lasted for about 18 months or so, a couple of years, while I was building up some copywriting credentials. So then I started writing advertising copy for different agencies around town. So I was doing press, radio, television. I met my current partner at one of these advertising agencies, and we left at the same time and formed our own practice in the early 90s. And so at the time it was called Crotchet, Quaver, Price and Staff. We got rid of the staff and we dropped the price, and it was just Crotchet, Quaver. And so Crotchet, Quaver was kind of an advertising, marketing and design agency that thrived through the early 1990s. And then in the second half of the 1990s, we kind of leapt sideways and took over a food business that my father-in-law had built up from the kitchen sink. And we did that because he suffered some ill health, and so we sort of... But that was a really bad idea from my point of view.
Because we're taking away from writing.
Yes, but not only that, I wasn't really built for the food business. So that lasted a 3 or 4 years, and then we went back into advertising, a bit more of a focus on design. So we kind of rebuilt our marketing practice into the towards, I don't know, till about 2012, 2013.
When did you start on the PhD?
2012. I started teaching students. So in 2005, one of my daughter's teachers came to me and said, I need two things in my classroom. I need a writer teaching my kids about writing and you're it. And I need an outside expert for my PhD and you're that too. So I developed a program called Born Storytellers in 2005. And basically what I did was I made a list of 10 things that, had I known before I started out as a writer, and would I have known these 10 things better, would it have made me a better writer? And that then became my 10-week course that I delivered to primary school students, upper primary school students. And so I delivered this 10-week course to them and then had them write and then had them edit. So it was basically a full semester of work. And the teacher said to me, this is something, you need to do something with this. So the Born Storytellers was this program that we ran in about 20 different schools and writing centres. We taught kids from lower primary through to adults at writing centres. With the kids programs, we published about 670 students in about 65 anthologies over a period of about 10 years. And we held these massive book launch events at the Perth Writers Festival. We were never invited to be on the calendar. We just rented a room and did it on Family Day. But they were massive events. So huge crowds would come to these things. To launch these books, and these kids would get up and read a piece from their work and never fall off the page, you know. And they'd never seen this. Mm. It's the first time they've seen their book, their work in a book, you know. And it was always treated as though it needs to sit on the shelf next to anyone else's book.
Yes.
And be equally valid.
Yes.
As a piece to read. So it was well edited and it was well designed and well presented.
That took you on taking it in to then formalising what you've been doing in the PhD.
Yeah, so I decided that I would complete my abandoned tertiary education, which I abandoned two or three times as a younger person to play rock and roll. I did an undergraduate degree. I then did a diploma of education. I started on a PhD and then interrupted that for a dip ed for a year because I thought, oh, look, I'll go and do a bit of teaching in high school because I need some money. But that wasn't for me either. And then the PhD. So the PhD started in 2012 and it was finished in 2018.
Tell me, for me it's very interesting, how did that formal discipline PhD process contribute to your writing skill?
I think it's I think it was a development of the idea that I could actually complete something and complete something that was worthy. My PhD was just a thing that enabled me to say that I've done this inquiry and I've made it worthwhile. My two principal supervisors are both Fremantle men, which is David Moody and Peter Taylor, both have retired, but the idea of the PhD was really a way of proving to myself that I can do this. I have a previous novel which I published in 2017, sort of mid that, but that took 20 years to write. You know, and it's nothing, it's not a thriller, it's a completely different piece of work, and I have a textbook on story craft as a writing practice.
But it seems to me, from everything you've been telling us, that you've found the genre, and you've found the characters, and you've found some themes that you want to keep developing.
Yes. I've always been a thriller reader. I grew up on a diet of Frederick Forsyth and John le Carré. I've always sort of been a thriller reader, and I've always been fascinated by the concept of politics. I think that's probably a family fascination as much as anything else. So even though it's kind of a crime novel because there's a murder and the murder has to be solved, it doesn't work like most crime novels because it's not a straight through plot. The plot is complex, and it involves a lot more than the simple murder and solution of the murder.
Well, the worrying part for the readers is that this may well be a case of art imitating life, and that's the uneasy part of the story all the way through. We might bring this to an end now. People will want to go out and order the book, and on the web page, as they read the story, they'll see where to click and to buy it. But I agree, I have to say, with what David Wish Wilson, Fremantle writer of note, said about your book. Poetic License is a clever thriller that won't disappoint. Absolutely correct.
Well, I hope not. I hope that it won't disappoint.
Kevin, it's been lovely meeting you, talking to you about the book and beyond the book. And good luck with the launch that's coming up soon. And we'll watch with interest for the new ones when they come out.
Thank you, Michael.